Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with thoracic surgical oncologist Dr. Harvey Pass to obtain an update on clinical research involving surgical intervention, and he began our conversation by commenting on clinical and research issues in selecting the procedure to remove a primary lesion.
It's very important that there's a shift now in the local management of lung cancer to individualize. The idea of lobectomies for everybody is evolving. And that's because we've recognized that a nodule is not a nodule is not a nodule. In other words, nodules differ with regard to how they look, whether they're solid or part solid, and that translates into differences in histology, and that translates now into differences in how the natural history of the lesion is. So we're not only looking at how it looks, but the size. And in fact, the new staging system calls this right to our attention. We see that smaller lesions within the stage one category do much better than larger lesions, and they're segregated now as to size. And therefore, there is great interest that started originally in Japan with the idea of, can we do less than lobectomies or sublobar type resections or even wedge resections for certain individuals? And that is now under active investigation in trials both in the United States as well as abroad. A CalGB trial is looking at the 2-centimeter lesion. And if the lesion is less than 2 centimeters, and if the lymph nodes are negative, there's a randomization in the operating room to doing either the standard of care, which is the lobectomy, or whether you would do a segmental resection, which is the new buzzword and should be a new buzzword, or wedge. So that trial is ongoing and may show us that for small lesions, indeed, a segmental resection, a portion of a lobe, may be just as good as a lobe. But of course, in all those cases, you must do a complete mediastinal lymph node dissection to make sure oncologists know what the complete staging is.
So how do patients respond when you talk about this randomization?
They're a little skittish, because they have heard that, well, this one got a lobectomy, and this one got a lobectomy done with this new technique, which is the VATS technique, and they were home in 3 days, and can you do this segmental stuff through a VATS technique? And in fact,
can you?
Yes, you can. And in fact, I do it in my practice. And certain segmentectomies are easier to do VATS, total VATS, than others, but you have to be specially approved on the trial to use VATS for the resections. And patients are very, very well informed about this, and they come to see you. And they also want to know, well, you know, if I have the lung function and I'm 60 years old and I'm not running in marathons anymore, why shouldn't I just get a lobectomy, doc? And so it's a little difficult, but certainly an incredibly important trial, because we have to think of patients having multicentric disease, this field effect, and we're getting more into the idea that patients are getting more lung cancers, the same patient. And if you do lung sparing, you may have a better chance later on to do a definitive local resection, which at this point is the standard of care in that patient who you preserved lung function before.
Interesting. What do we know about the difference in morbidity, days in the hospital, et cetera, using, for example, VATS?
For doing a VATS segmentectomy, the largest series of these come from Rob McKenna from California, as well as a couple of reports from New York institutions and Japan. And the patients have the same sort of air leak time. They have the same sort of chest tube out time. But again, the types of segmental resections that we're doing are pretty simple at this point. They're called basilar segmentectomies or superior segmentectomies. They seem to be easier in the lower lobes than in the upper lobes. Some people even classify a right middle lobectomy as a segmental type resection. Well, those should have exactly the same morbidity as a standard complete VATS lobectomy. But in the future, segmentectomies by VATS is going to be a standard of care, in my opinion.
And another interesting question. I think I saw an editorial that you wrote about a paper looking at the difference in immune function based on the type of surgery. I thought that was really interesting. It was in a surgical journal.
Absolutely. And this is a really hot topic. There had been some allusions to the idea that it's a kinder, gentler operation, meaning complete VATS. And remember, we have to separate. The complete VATS means no rib spreading, small incisions, not one of these things where you make a small incision, but you put a retractor in and you're spreading the ribs and you got the light in there. That's not a complete VATS. Complete VATS is minimal surgical trauma. And indeed, the data that was published showed that all the immune, at least on the cellular side, tests were preserved or recovered quicker with the VATS approach as opposed to the standard approach. And possibly this could translate into survival or time to progression or recurrence parameters. I think this is real, and we're just touching the surface of how we're looking at the immune system and how it's influenced by trauma surgery.
I thought the other point that you made in the editorial was the translational nature of the project and the issue of surgeons becoming more interested in that. You know, in breast cancer, we have all the preoperative issues, getting tissue, trying to, you know, look for markers of responses, et cetera. Do you see the surgical community in lung cancer interested in this?
Absolutely. I mean, you're actually preaching to the choir here because I've been a staunch advocate that surgeons are the first line of discovery. The surgeons in the operating room are able to approach the patient, get tissue, archive tissue, get blood, and serve as a resource as well as an intellectual resource, because when you get into personalized therapy, which is what everybody's interested in now, we have a series of things that we need. We need tissue. We need to question that tissue for certain genes or for certain proteins. Well, who better than to have that when in the first stages of discovery, you may not be able to use paraffin-based techniques. So the surgeon serves a very important role there and also needs to be able to know what the impact of the translational studies are so that he can counsel the patient about preoperative situations.
Not to get too far out on a tangent, but just in terms of this translational concept and tissue biomarkers, I've been a little bit perplexed why particularly patients who go for surgical resection, particularly like non-smokers, don't get routine, you know, for example, EGFR mutation status. I mean, it seems like that translational model hasn't really quite gotten into lung cancer surgery yet. Or do you disagree?
No, I think that there is now a trend at every conference that I'm at. One of the questions asked to the audience is, do you routinely send off tissue for some sort of EGF or KRAS evaluation? And right now, it's between 40% at the high ones and 50%. At the universities, there seems to be higher. But specific to our situation, we absolutely believe that almost every patient now should have queries. Why? Because biomarkers need validation. And many of these biomarkers are discovered. There's a couple of tests that are done, a couple of reports, but no large-scale validation. And we need to have a registry. Now, how do you get these done? Well, they're mainly done through companies at this point. So at least you will have an ongoing registry of the companies that are doing the usual tests now, EGF and KRAS, for either mutational analysis or FISH. And in the future, we'll have even more, like our MM1 and ERCC1, that will be able to query the databases.
What about RT-PCR? You know, in breast cancer, you have the Oncotype assay that's completely changed the way patients are approached. Colon cancer, actually, they're starting to put together a similar effort in a couple of different fronts.
Correct.
Is anything like that going on in lung cancer?
Absolutely. I mean, the CalGB Cooperative Group is also running a trial using what's called the Metagene, which is the profile that was originally looked at by Dave Harpaugh and the group at Duke, which is able to predict bad actors in stage one. So they're looking at one profile of genes, which is able to separate stage one patients into patients who do not live as long as others, but they're all stage one. So independent of stage, the genes are telling you what's happening. And maybe those patients deserve to get adjuvant therapy, even though our present standard of care is not to consider adjuvant therapy in stage 1A unless you've got a lesion greater than 4 centimeters. So these are being looked at now in large trials.
Maybe we can do a Harvey Pass Journal Club and a Harvey Pass Tumor Board here. And I wanted to ask you about a couple other of your papers, and you had submitted a couple cases that we could chat about. What about your editorial last July in the JCO, which was discussing this paper by Hirth et al., looking at endobronchial ultrasound? Can you comment on what they looked at and what you discussed in your editorial?
Right. The question is whether you can do the very difficult staging or restaging of stage 3A lung cancer patients who have had induction therapy before they get operated on. Mainly because the whole idea of patients with lymph node positive 3A disease, if they have persistence of their positivity in the mediastinum at the time of their resection, this has been pointed out in a number of studies, starting really with Kathy Albane's study that shows that persistent N2 disease is a bad prognostic factor. Those patients do not do as well, even with surgery after chemoradiation therapy. So maybe we shouldn't put the patient through potentially dangerous surgery with risks that can be 5 to 7%, depending upon the series. So you need a better way of knowing that. And the use of endobronchial ultrasound, in which you're able to bronchoscope the patient, actually see the nodes using a transducer on the outside, able to actually then stick a needle in the node, aspirate, and then have an answer to whether that lymph node is involved without having to violate the mediastinum again, because how did you get that original biopsy? It was a mediastinoscopy. And to reevaluate that with a redo mediastinoscopy, although it's been done and done fairly well by European surgeons and some American surgeons, it's very difficult and you're going to skimp. This way, you're not making an incision. You can do it all from inside the bronchus. And what they showed, though, was that, yes, they could get a diagnosis, but the accuracy was not that great. It wasn't as good as we'd like it to be.
Compared to what?
Compared to mediastinoscopy.
So meaning, these patients also got mediastinoscopy?
They got mediastinoscopy first, but if you compare the yield, truly, of mediastinoscopy, plus the fact all these patients got operated on, so they were able to compare their EBUS findings
right
to their surgical findings. And they had patients that still had lymph node disease that they weren't able to find, or patients that were false negatives. So what does it all mean? It means that you have a technique that you can evaluate the mediastinum that works very well. But when does it work very well? It works very well if potentially you could do it first. So I think there needs to be a shift, as I said in the editorial, to the use of endobronchial ultrasound first. Why? Most patients are going to get PET scans. So if you get a PET scan on a patient and you have this beautiful roadmap of where the positive lymph node is or lymph nodes are, then if you combine that with doing an endobronchial ultrasound and go right to that area or sample as many nodes as you want, but you make sure you get the PET scan positive ones, you'll get a diagnosis of whether that patient has N2 disease or not. Now, if you get that using endobronchial ultrasound, the mediastinum has been untouched. You have a clear mediastinum. When is the most important thing to decide whether that patient has had a great response to chemo or chemo and radiation therapy? It's before you're going to make the decision to operate. So save your mediastinoscopy, which is the gold standard where you can really look at all the nodes and make sure that you don't have any sampling error, for the time just before you're evaluating that patient for surgery. You may find that you have persistently positive disease in the mediastinum, despite the fact that the CT scan has showed a response or the PET scan shows that it's less FDG avid. If you get a positive biopsy in the mediastinum at that point, you may not want to do an operation.
And that actually leads into something else I was curious your thoughts about, which is the research now that's starting to look at the issue of combined chemo radiation, EGFR antibody / cetuximab, and how that sort of has come out of the head and neck model. Can you talk about, I know there was some data presented at the Chicago meeting on this, what we know about this right now and sort of where things are heading?
Well, we know from a trial that was done by George Blumenstein from MD Anderson. When you took cetuximab and added it to the usual cassette of chemo and radiation therapy, the responses certainly were some of the best, and the survival for that trial compared to previous RTOG trials was extraordinary. Something like 48%, 3 to 5 year survival, no surgery, just really dramatic. And it could be done safely, although you had to be careful, as you would be with any targeted therapy, when you give it with chemo and radiation therapy. The move now has been, can you extend this? And in fact, RTOG is looking to now do a trial in which patients will actually have surgery to combine this cassette with a higher dose of radiation therapy plus cetuximab followed by surgery to see whether you actually improve local control and survival. So it's, let's just say, a new idea with regard to adding targeted therapy and also improving local control with surgery.
Interesting. Do you think that the use of cetuximab in a patient receiving chemo radiation or radiation therapy for a locally advanced tumor is a reasonable non-protocol option to consider for a patient at this point?
Certainly, that's going to be adapted by certain individuals who think that that's a standard of care. I'm not so sure it's the best thing to do at this point because there have been some reports of some toxicities associated with the cetuximab, and we need to have further validation of what the proper dose is and whether you can go higher on the dose, because people are now moving toward higher doses of radiation therapy in the situation of local regional 3A disease. So I would not like to see a targeted agent all of a sudden be used with non-standard radiation doses with chemo at this point.
How do you approach this in your own institution? Do your patients actually get endobronchial ultrasound first in this situation?
Yes, they do. The reason that this is easier at my institution is that one of my initiatives when I first came to NYU was to actually have the surgeons do the endobronchial ultrasound. So our group actually got the machine at all the hospitals that we work at. So we became, let's just say, after a learning curve, pretty good at endobronchial ultrasound. But also we do rapid on-site evaluation, which means we have the cytologist tell us when we aspirate in the operating room whether we've got lymph node and whether we've got suspicious cells. So to answer your question, yes. Now we have a patient that has 3A disease or suspected 3A disease, we will start with a endobronchial ultrasound. And then if we're still suspicious and we have a hot node and we just didn't get it, then we'll do a mediastinoscopy. But we can now get the diagnosis very nicely with endobronchial ultrasound and save the mediastinoscopy for later on.
Another paper I wanted to ask you about and actually briefly touch on the topic of mesothelioma was a study that you were part of looking at, quote, a National Mesothelioma Virtual Bank. Can you talk a little bit about that effort and where we are right now with mesothelioma?
It's very important for orphan diseases that material be available to as many investigators as possible so that new discovery can occur. So through the University of Pittsburgh, that actually won an award from the CDC originally, a group of us participated with University of Pittsburgh and have banks of mesothelioma tissue as well as serum and pleural effusion that we've all used for our own studies, that now we've combined and done it in a formal way such that we can entertain proposals from individuals. We've already fulfilled one of those, and we have another one that we're doing right now, in which they request, say, to look at a certain gene, and then we'll look to see what they want, whether they want paraffin or fresh frozen, and then we'll get out of our archives whatever they need and send it to them, and then they can do it. It's a very important effort.
Totally. I think it's incredible. I love it.
But this is just the beginning. There are other foundations, as a matter of fact, that I'm involved with that are trying to do this also, because it's very difficult when you have a government-sponsored situation or individual investigators to try and get a hold of specimens. I think in a foundation setting where groups of individuals can work together and then freely donate the stuff, it may work just as well. And we're looking into that for lung cancer.
The other thing I've noticed or I've been hearing, and it kind of makes sense, you know, I've talked to a lot of patients about this, is that they like the idea of translational research. It makes sense to patients. So I'm curious. I assume that the patients that you've talked to about this like it.
Wherever I've been, we have always had a tissue procurement protocol, which is the beginnings of doing translational sort of stuff. And very frankly, in my experience, either I approach the patient or I have a nurse practitioner or I have a research assistant approaching the patient. I mean, the ability to accrue to trials like that and to get the tissue, which is the beginning, is in the neighborhood of 92 to 93%. It's very few individuals who will say, sure, you can use the blood. It's all anonymized. Nobody will know whose blood it is or whose tissue it is, and the tissue will not interfere with the pathology diagnosis. That is a rich resource, and that's why I really would like to see this expanded in some way, but it's expensive, and surgeons who do it are either funded or have some way of archiving the tissue, but it's incredibly important, and we need it because we don't want to make mistakes. We want to have validation. So if we discover a gene in one cohort, we want to use somebody else's cohort, completely separate state or some other place, to show that it's the same gene and it has the same effect. So it's very important that we amass this in very robust ways with good demographics.
So, Harvey, I have a dream, but I don't know if it'll ever occur, where every single cancer patient in the United States has their tissue and sera banked.
I would love to see that. It gets into the idea of registries.
Right.
We now have the informatics. If we can do the human genome and we can look at millions of SNPs, then we ought to have a way that we can log this information in a web-based fashion so that we can communicate with each other. We do it already with gene arrays. We have 50,000 genes. Results are posted on the web. Investigators can go into there and look at the genes. Well, why not collect the tissues, have the demographics, and then be able to share these in some way? And I think it would require funding, but it's sort of one of those things where you lobby for, maybe through the DOD, but to try and get funding for it.
Anything new and exciting in mesothelioma?
I think so. The most important thing is that there's going to be a completely new staging system. We're meeting next week in London to go over the staging system. A number of us have contributed all of our cases to do just like it was done with the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer. In fact, this is an ISLC initiative to be able to now do it in mesothelioma. Not only that, but the investigators who are doing the translational work and have the tissue will be there also. So we'll be able to know in the future, can we now morph this into molecular diagnostics and molecular staging like we're trying to do in lung cancer? And we desperately need that because we need to figure out what to do with a small piece of tissue at the time of diagnosis that'll tell us this patient needs this or this patient needs that or you shouldn't do this. That will be very, very useful independent of staging.
So I want to talk about your two patients, but before I do, I want to get a second opinion on a case that's also being presented on the same program that you're going to be on by Dr. Kamaki, radiation oncologist from MD Anderson. And kind of relevant to what you were talking about before, she presented an older patient who had prior surgery for lung cancer, now had a second lung cancer, and really was felt by the surgeons that he didn't have enough pulmonary reserve to tolerate surgery. This patient had had a really good result from stereotactic radiation. And she was talking about that effort that they have looking at stereotactic radiation, what they've been seeing and their interest. And they actually have a study trying to randomize between surgery and stereotactic radiation. What do you think about this whole strategy and this research question?
I think you may have asked the right person or the wrong person, because as the lung cancer surgeon for the RTOG, Bob Timmerman and I are actually the PIs of the trial, a national trial, in which we take patients who actually are now surgical candidates, lesions less than 5 centimeters, people who would have a lobectomy otherwise. These patients, in a very carefully constructed phase 2 study, will get SBRT to the lesion with PET scans pre and post and CAT scans pre and post to see whether this is a feasible thing to do. I think Ritzko is correct. I think that we're moving toward a time now to look at SBRT for patients who otherwise may be resectable, because the data in unresectable patients has been very promising, with incredible control rates at 2 years of 95% in these patients. It's a logical step. Of course, you have to have a diagnosis. You need to make sure you know what you're treating. But surgeons are a little reticent to accept this. They need to understand that there's still a surgical option even after the patients will get this if the patient recurs. And the morbidity of that is not going to be too bad, especially if you limit it to the peripheral lesions that get treated. So I'm an advocate of investigating that modality. The randomized trial, I think, is a little premature. We need to define in the resectable patients exactly what the responses are going to be and exactly how, let's just say, much control we have and how durable the control is before we move to a randomized trial.
You know, I was telling her that in a way, I know it's completely different. It kind of reminded me of the SPIRIT trial that they tried to do in prostate cancer, comparing implants sure. to surgery, and they could never, you know, actually get it done, but people just sort of started doing it. And do you think in a patient who could tolerate surgery, but who just doesn't want to have it, or maybe they're just a little bit older, that this is a reasonable option?
Absolutely. I do think that for patients who refuse surgery or are not surgical candidates on the basis of age, if they have a peripheral lesion, outer third zone of the lung, then I do think that this is a very good option for those patients. Of course, we do not have 10-year follow-up on patients like that at this point, but the intermediate results, 3 to 5 years, are very promising. So at selective centers that are experts, and it takes excellent physics, it takes different machines that are done, you need to investigate and do your due diligence as to where you're going to go. But I do think that that is a very good option.
So I always like cases that involve people in their 80s, because, you know, it's really so common and so problematic. And one of the patients you were going to discuss was an 82-year-old woman. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Sure. This was a lady that had had a previous malignancy and was a very vigorous lady. And she had been followed for colon cancer, was completely resected, had a laparoscopic colectomy, and did fine. But
and she had breast cancer too?
Yes. And at the time of her workup, she was found to have a ground glass opacity in the right upper lobe. So her original operation was in 2007. When I first saw her, it was about a year and a half later, or a year later. And so she now presents with the ground glass opacity that's changed. It's a little bit more solid. And in fact, when you got a PET scan on this lady, ground glass opacities, if they've got PET activity, I'm very concerned about them, especially if these are the ground glass opacities that haven't responded to antibiotics, that have been persistent, and they've changed a little bit in morphology.
She's a smoker?
She was a non-smoker. So she fits into this pattern that we're seeing of patients who get CAT scans who are non-smokers that have these ground glass opacities and what to do about it. So fortunately, this was not lost to follow-up. This patient was followed very, very closely with serial CT scans and finally had a PET scan that showed some activity. And the question was, what are you going to do in this 82-year-old lady that's had two malignancies, albeit both cured, to take care of this lesion in the lung?
And I guess there would be an issue about whether this could have been a met.
Absolutely. But it's very unusual for a ground glass opacity to look like a metastasis. You'd wonder, is this more like lymphangitic spread, but localized like this? Not really. So pretty much the idea of a ground glass opacity in a non-smoker, which we think is associated from studies that have been published, we think it may be a lung cancer. And if you've had two malignancies, and certainly you could have a third.
So what happened?
So we spoke to her, and this lady wanted to have this taken care of. So in an 82-year-old lady where, again, you want to do what's best but minimal, she had a VATS lobectomy, which was uncomplicated, and she did fine.
What was seen pathologically?
This was actually an invasive adenocarcinoma, which we suspected because of the solid component. It wasn't just one of these, quote, BACs that has no invasion. It was indeed a mixed tumor that had evolved that who knows what would happen to this. Is this one of these overdiagnosed cases? I don't know. But certainly when you have invasion, I'm a little bit more concerned.
Now, did you send the tumor for EGFR mutation?
We did, and she is mutated, but she did not want to go on any adjuvant trials at this point. So we have it in the bank.
So she was, what, a 19 or 21?
19.
Wow. So does that make you more, because I'm still kind of thinking, okay, yeah, but adenocarcinoma, could this be a MET? I guess the EGFR mutation seals it as lung cancer.
It does, but even better was the TTF1s, I guess,
right.
And all the immunohistological staining.
Right.
Certainly gave us an idea that this was a lung cancer.
Did you do ER and HER2 on her?
We did, and those were negative.
Interesting. So what's her situation right now?
Saw her in the clinic about 2 weeks ago, and she's doing great. So she has no evidence of any other disease, no other GGOs that we're concerned about at this point. So she continues to be followed at 3-month intervals for the first 2 years.
How long was she actually in the hospital?
She was in the hospital for 4 days.
And any problems at all?
Not really. I mean, these patients have, in my opinion, although it's not been shown, a little less complications from arrhythmias, but of course she's on a beta blocker beforehand. We get the patients up very quickly. We give them heparin prophylaxis. So they have minimal pain. And that also eases their, let's just say, hospital stay. The epidural comes out earlier in these patients. It comes out at 2 days instead of 3 days. So you're moving the patient toward home earlier.
So, you know, we do these patterns of care studies all the time where we ask oncologists, randomly selected, or surgeons, and here's the situation, what do you do? So I think this would be a great case to throw out for a survey in terms of would you bring up the issue and be okay with giving this woman erlotinib as adjuvant therapy? You said in her situation, answer was no, right?
Correct.
Okay, then what we do is we go, okay, now instead of 82, she's 72.
Right.
Still? No erlotinib?
Yeah.
Right for you?
For me, I would still hold.
Okay. How about 62?
Now I'm starting to become worried because
yeah.
The time for the development of a new lung cancer certainly is there.
Well, also they have the issue of recurrence.
Absolutely.
It'd be interesting to see how just the number of somebody's age will affect, you know, decisions. And this is interesting because I think probably, I'll bet you most oncologists would not use erlotinib if the patient was 82. I think maybe a few would start. I would be exactly kind of like you, but I'm very interested to find that out. This case actually brings up another paper in the Harvey Pass Journal Club I forgot to ask you about before related to surgery on lung mets.
Yes.
And I should tell you that actually we're in the middle of this monstrous project for over a year now, working with Peter Ravden on a new education program for adjuvant looking at surgery for liver mets and colon cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been like completely imbued with this idea of surgery. Actually, we're calling the thing MET resect. And hopefully someday we could bring in lung and these other things. But can you comment a little bit about the paper that you were commenting on in your editorial there about resection of lung mets and what your point was again in that editorial?
Right, that was a paper in JTO, and it was sort of a let's look at another series of lung metastases from a European cohort and see whether it's sort of like the International Registry, which is the gold standard paper that Ugo Pastorino put us all together and did in the late 1990s, early 2000s.
Now, these are all types of primaries?
Yes. And indeed, it again showed that there were certain parameters that patients did seem to derive benefit. Of course, it's not a randomized trial as to looking at surgery for a single metastasis versus some other therapy or chemotherapy, although most of these patients, one of the things that you say to these patients is that they have no further chemotherapy options. And it really did reinforce the fact that, yes, you can do this, you can do it safely. Patients who have small numbers of nodules, specifically one, seem to do the best, and patients who have melanomas don't seem to do very well. But for patients with sarcomas, those patients, osteosarcomas, they seem to do very well. So I think that it's nice to have some sort of validation of this, but again, we don't have the answers. Now, is this a situation where for single or a couple of mets documented SBRT or RFA may be a good option? Absolutely. And that's being looked at. But to answer that question, which is in the editorial, we got to do the trials. We've got to be able to identify the patients and then do the trials to compare the two to see which is better and which is more cost effective and to see which is best for the patients. But that's in the future.
Yeah, trials are tough when surgery is involved. And I don't even think there's actually been a phase 3 study looking at liver mets and colon cancer. There have been European studies. But one of the things that's come out of that, and I wonder whether it applies to your types of patients with the lung mets, is trying to assess the biology. And of course, you can see how long it's been since they had their diagnosis. But trying to assess the biology, but also maybe whether or not they have something that can respond to systemic therapy. And in colon, they talk about, particularly the Europeans, well, let's give them pre-op therapy, see whether or not they respond. We'll see if they declare themselves with other meds, you know, other places before we commit them to surgery. Does that kind of strategy make sense for lung meds?
Neil, that actually takes me back, to my days of the NCI. We felt that kids seem to respond better to chemotherapies than adults. And that's because, of course, we're dealing with adult soft tissue sarcomas versus the children, the pediatric sarcomas. And indeed, if you put them on MAID and they had innumerable mets, you would invariably have patients, kids, that would have a nice response. You'd be left with a couple of metastases and you would operate on those patients and you were able to do a complete resection. Part of it is figuring out what is the agent that you can give, say, to the adult population that's going to be a winner so that then you could potentially decrease the volume of metastases so then you could possibly do some sort of local operation. But I agree with you. We're limited now by our lack of understanding in a lot of cases of the nature of metastases and exactly then what to treat with.
Well, also in my fantasy with the tissue and all is a complete electronic database of every single patient and what happens to them so that you could pull up every single patient who had this and just see kind of what happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess, I don't know if we could get a little bit of that bailout money to, you know, do that.
Exactly.
Not likely. Okay, let's go on to your 57-year-old patient.
This is a very interesting gentleman who actually was in perfect health. This is an art gallery owner who actually is an ambassador, who was a gold medalist, weightlifter, armed forces guy. His father was a doctor at Mount Sinai and was one of the early proponents of never smoking. He never smoked. And sure enough, he gets his hip operated on. He gets a CAT scan at the time of his hip being operated on because a chest x-ray was abnormal. And he's got a left hilar mass. And this individual then is found to have a metastasis, but only after getting a PET scan and mediastinal validation. But we treated him with the state-of-the-art way that we had talked about before.
You said metastasis?
Yeah, he had a metastasis to a lymph node in the mediastinum that we were able to find using endobronchial ultrasound.
Just what you talked about before. So what happened then?
Well, then we went ahead and gave him chemo radiation therapy. And he had a nice response, both in the primary tumor as well as in the lymph nodes. We took him back to the operating room. This was a left-sided tumor, so the evaluation of the mediastinum is still pretty difficult on the left because, remember, you have a hyalur mass, you've had radiation. He's had an endobronchial ultrasound that showed the right side is okay and the left side had a node that was positive, subcarinal. We operated on him and found that he indeed had a complete response in the tumor, but not in the lymph nodes. So he had residual disease in the lymph nodes, but still had a complete resection by lobectomy. It's unfortunate for a patient like this to have residual disease in the lymph nodes, but it would be more unfortunate if you had to do a pneumonectomy on a patient like this. So this patient then did get consolidation chemotherapy, as controversial as it is. And at this point, he has no evidence of disease. He is now at least, let's just say, 2 years out from when I operated on him. So we're feeling good about this man, but we're cautious.
What kind of chemo did he get with the radiation? What kind did he get after the surgery?
He got etoposide platinum along with radiation therapy, and then got consolidation docetaxel, because that was the 2 years ago. I mean, you have the reports that that's okay. We can think about this at this point. And then the controversy came with the Hogg study.
Right. So if he were presenting today, you know, I don't know, would he have gotten the docetaxel maintenance?
At my institution, there would be some caution about doing that.
I guess one of the things I think about with all that, and it kind of like hasn't been that much discussed, I think, since the Hogg trial got presented, but you still have a sort of kind of weird situation where you're not really given what oncologists would consider to be a normal duration of systemic therapy to try to deal with a microscopic disease in patients who actually have a higher chance of having it. It's sort of counterintuitive.
Correct. And what you're alluding to is the idea of almost maintenance therapy. And so,
or, you know, just longer pseudo adjuvant therapy. Not like indefinite, but maybe just like in rectal cancer, where you get some pre-op with the chemo and then you just get regular FOLFOX adjuvant afterwards.
This whole idea of what to give afterwards is a very touchy point. It would be great, frankly, if we had some way of inquiring the tumor and we really knew what would be the appropriate agent to give, and maybe that's going to move along with ERCC1 and RMM1 now, so that if you had the patient that got platinum up front and then you have tissue and you have enough to show that indeed he either does or does not have a mutation, you'll base your therapy on that, and we're going to be guided by the studies that are now ongoing to look at that.
Can you talk about what we know right now about ERCC1 and RMM1?
We know that these are genes that are associated with cisplatinum and gemcitabine resistance, so that these actually repair problems that are caused by environmental attacks on the DNA. So they're DNA repair enzymes. So if indeed you have ERCC1 and it's elevated, the patients may not respond to platinum the way they should. So you may not want to use a platinum agent. Now, with RMM1, it's the same situation. So these are now being looked at to see whether you can decide what chemotherapy to use based on what the genes are telling you will be most efficacious.
But now RMM1 is for GEM, right?
That's correct.
Interesting. What are your thoughts about the big ECOG adjuvant BEV study? You know, right now we've got a big trial in breast that they're accruing to. There's a huge colon trial that already is accruing that we're waiting for results in. We're seeing it being looked at in ovary in an early situation, et cetera. What are your thoughts about the lung BEV study?
I'm hoping that it's going to get all the accrual that it needs. And it's a question that has to be answered. I mean, if you're a believer that indeed the BEV study was important in the American population and actually had a survival advantage, then the next movement is to see whether in an adjuvant situation it is actually going to improve survival. So I am a supporter of it. I think that giving antibody is a little difficult for the patients. It's going to be safer because the lesion is out. You're going to make sure the patients don't have other disease that could cause them to have problems. You'll manage the hypertension. I think that's all going to be manageable. But the idea that it's intravenous and it's very costly, that worries me a little bit, as well as the fact that I would have rejoiced more if there was actually a larger survival advantage seen in these studies done that really justified this trial.
And I guess the other issue is wound healing. And we do, of course, it's different, but we do have the data now from the colon study, at least the initial safety data, that looked pretty good, I thought, in terms of wound healing. What did you think about that data, and what about the specific situation in terms of lung cancer?
I don't have a problem with having bevacizumab given to the patients. We all try to wait between 4 to 6 weeks after you do this, and there really haven't been any problems that I've seen in the population of patients that I've operated on. I mean, I've even had patients that had mesothelioma that got bev up front that I've then operated on, but I've usually waited a little bit of time before I've done their operation.